Talk to us now and go to the TNT Radio Interactive Live chat room at tntradio.live. Lighting the fuse for freedom. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT. Cutting through the clutter, this is the Misty Winston Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Well, hey there. Thank you so much, as always, for tuning in to the Misty Winston Show here on TNT Radio. Happy Friday to you. I hope wherever you are in the world, you had a fantastic week and have amazing plans for your weekend. I plan to be kind of lazy this weekend, frankly. All right. So a quick look ahead at what we have coming up next week. Monday, as we've already discussed, we have Gabriel Shipton coming on the show. Gabriel is Julian Assange's brother, as well as the co-producer of the film Ithaca, which is a behind-the-scenes look at the family's fight to free Julian. With the latest developments in the case, that is a conversation you're not going to want to miss. So make sure you tune in on Monday. Tuesday, my good friend Kit Cabello from Hardlands Media is going to be here. Wednesday, we have Ian Schlachman and the legendary Reverend Annie Chambers coming to the show. Thursday, we have my friend Esha, who is currently living in Moscow, on the show. And then Friday, we have Connor Freeman from the Libertarian Institute. So another fantastic week here on the Misty Winston Show. Make sure you don't miss a minute right here on TNT Radio. And before we dive into the hour, I have some disturbing news to discuss with you. There was recently an investigation into Instagram, which is a Meta-owned company. It's not good. So in a 2,800-word article published on Wednesday in the Wall Street Journal, there's an expose out. They conducted an investigation into child pornography on Instagram. And if you have kids, you're going to want to pay very close attention to what I'm about to tell you. So this is from the article. Quote, pedophiles have long used the internet, but unlike the forums and file transfer services that cater to people who have an interest in illicit content, Instagram doesn't merely host these activities. Its algorithms promote them. Instagram connects pedophiles and guides them to content sellers via recommendation systems that excel at linking those who share niche interests, which the idea that they just called this a niche interest is disturbing. But I think the broader point here is that they are just trying to say that this isn't just a matter of Instagram having this content available on its platform. They are actively connecting these types of people, if you want to call them that, to each other. So this is like a very, I mean, this is an incredibly dangerous situation. If you have kids and they're on Instagram, I have kids and they are not allowed on Instagram. But if your kids are on Instagram, this is a big deal. So a Meta spokesperson said that the company is, quote, continuously exploring ways to actively defend against this behavior. And we set up an internal task force to investigate these claims and immediately address them, end quote. So they've acknowledged that the company in some cases receives reports of child sexual abuse and fail to act on them, which is horrendously unforgivable. And they are claiming that it is a software error that prevented them from being processed, which I don't know how that's a valid excuse, but that's what they're saying. In addition, they also said, quote, we provided updated guidance to our content reviewers to more easily identify and remove predatory accounts. They also went on to say, quote, child exploitation is a horrific crime. We work aggressively to fight it on and off our platforms and to support law enforcement in its efforts to arrest and prosecute the criminals behind it. Predators constantly change their tactics in their pursuit to harm children. And that's why we have strict policies and technology to prevent them from finding or interacting with teens on our apps and hire specialist teams who focus on understanding their evolving behavior so we can eliminate abusive networks. So apparently between 2020 and 2022, their policy enforcement teams dismantled 27 abuse networks. That is according to them. And in January 2023, they say that they disabled more than 490,000 accounts for violating child safety policies. As of the fourth quarter of 2022, Meta's technology removed more than 34 million pieces of child sexual exploitation content from Facebook and Instagram, more than 98% of which was detected before it was reported by users. 34 million pieces of child sexual exploitation content. That is staggering. I mean, I knew that this was a huge problem, but that's staggering. Okay, so according to the journal's report, they said, quote, technical and legal hurdles make determining the full scale of the pedophile network on Instagram hard for anyone outside Meta to measure precisely. And the article cited the Stanford Internet Observatory research team's identification of 405 sellers of what the researchers deemed, quote unquote, self-generated child sex material using hashtags associated with underage sex. I'm not going to say some of these hashtags because they're pretty vile. The Wall Street Journal story also cited data compiled via network mapping software. And this is not even just the sellers. There are also, apparently there's trading, like they do trades. And so there will be, you know, certain pages that are set up to have, it looks like some of them, it just looks like child models, but they are kind of suggestively dressed and things like that. But I think that that is, those are kind of, you know, just a front. And then people will, in the comments, will be asking for trades or for selling or whatever. It's all just very disgusting and mind-blowing to me. So I just wanted to bring this to you because I am a mother, and this kind of thing freaks me out. And this is obviously a very big problem on Instagram and on Meta in general. I will say, to their credit, Twitter seems to have been a little bit better at handling this type of a situation. In fact, it mentions in the article, it says, among other internet platforms, Snapchat and TikTok do not appear to facilitate networks of pedophiles seeking child abuse content in the way that Instagram has. According to the Journal report, on Twitter, the Stanford Internet Observatory team identified 128 accounts offering to sell child sex abuse content. According to the researchers, Twitter didn't recommend such accounts to the same degree as Instagram and Twitter. And Twitter also removed such accounts, quote unquote, far more quickly, the Journal reported. So to Twitter's credit, they seem to be a little bit more on the ball on this sort of a thing. But I'm a mom. I wanted to bring this to you because if you have kids, I'm sure that this is something you worry about too. So make sure you're monitoring your kids' internet activity. It's scary out there. Okay. Don't forget, you can follow me over on the tweeters at Sarcasm Stardust. Check out the Substack, mistywinston.substack.com. There is a write-up every day for the guest of the day so that you can find, follow, and support their work as well. And if you missed your favorite TNT radio show or interview, you can listen back anytime you want, wherever you want. Just visit the episodes tab on the TNT radio website, which is tntradio.live. And then we are also on all the major podcast platforms, including Apple, Google, Spotify, Amazon, Podbean, iHeart, and TuneIn. So now there is no reason to miss out on anything on TNT radio.
Clashing on the controversies.
It's a woke society, and I am fed up with it.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Okie doke. A new poll indicates that bipartisan skepticism of federal spying practices is on the rise. Good. A fact that could make the Biden administration's push to renew certain powers under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, otherwise known as FISA, more challenging. Here with the story, joining me now is TNT Radio News producer Adam Clark, a.k.a. Ruckus. What's going on here, Adam?
It's kind of ironic, too, because does this even matter? Because this is one of those political polls. Plus, the information that was collected was from March. I'm not discrediting this story. It is important. But I find the timing funny because at the beginning of this week, we were hearing the results of another recent poll from the Cato Institute. And I think pretty much everyone on TNT has been talking about this, mentioned it at least once or twice. But millennials, Gen Z, not millennials, I guess they're the same thing, right? That they are okay with having like government surveillance devices installed inside their houses to reduce domestic violence, abuse, and other illegal activity. So this is in the wake of that. But this one was put out by the Associated Press's. So, you know, take all of this with a grain of salt. This is the NORC Center for Public Affairs Research who did this poll. And yes, as I mentioned, the data was collected. They did this poll between March 16th to the 20th, and it showed that Republicans and Democrats espouse similar views on government surveillance tactics, though Republicans' willingness to forfeit some liberties for safety has significantly declined over the last decade. I'm very happy to hear this because this is important. Yes. When it comes to, you know, lawmakers in particular. So overall, 48% of respondents said they believed it was, quote unquote, sometimes necessary for the government to sacrifice some rights and freedoms to combat terrorism, which is down from 54% in 2021 and 64% in 2011. So we're finally below the halfway point. Oh, my goodness, this is great. Among Republicans, the decline was even greater, with just 44% responding in the affirmative, compared with 69% in 2011. For Democrats, the shift was more minimal. 55% agreed, compared with 59% in 2011. And then the new survey also touched on several surveillance practices that were authorized under FISA Section 702, a hot topic. this past year in particular, when asked whether they were in favor of the U.S. government listening to phone calls made outside the United States without a warrant, 44% of respondents said they opposed the practice, compared with 28% who responded favorably. An additional 28%, they neither favored nor opposed the practice. Like, I don't care. Participants responded similarly regarding the warrantless monitoring of foreign nationals' emails and internet searches. So I'm sure most people are familiar with FISA. They're probably familiar with Section 702. But, you know, I think maybe finally we're shifting past that. I think Obama, this was very big under Obama, this whole concept, yes, that everyone agreed with, like, oh, well, if you have nothing to hide, you have like the see something, say something mantra back in the day. So I'm just curious what your thoughts are about this, and if you think this is an actual sign that people's minds are changed about the government spying on them.
Well, I think it's changed for now. However, the problem is that they are likely to throw another false flag or some other shenanigans at us, and then people's minds will change again. And that's what's frustrating. But my overall general sentiment is surveillance is bad. The United States government should not be surveilling any of us. It is ridiculous. What's astonishing to me is that there were so many people who didn't have an opinion. It says an additional 28% said they neither favored nor opposed the practice. How do you not have an opinion on an issue like this? And we know, thanks to Ed Snowden and some other whistleblowers throughout time, that they have been spying on us in various different ways, including, I mean, thanks to WikiLeaks Vault 7 releases in March of 2017, we know that they can use your smartphone, or not your smartphone, I'm sorry, your smart TV. They can manipulate your car. Our cars are all computer operated now, right? So they can now basically hack into your car as you're driving. I'm not saying they're going to do that, but I'm just saying that they could. It's a terrifying prospect. And I've been saying this for some time. The way that it should be is that there should be full and complete transparency among power. We should know what they're doing. We should know, obviously there are some things we can't know, but I think generally speaking, there should be full transparency for those people in positions of power. And then the people, the general public, should have full privacy. And that is, it's completely flip-flopped right now. They know everything about us, Adam. They know where we eat, where we shop, where our kids go to school, what our favorite gas station to stop at, our favorite snack, what size shoe we wear. I mean, they know literally everything about us, and they are able to weaponize that information against us in terms of the way that they propagandize us. And now we have these social media companies who are also doing that same thing and giving the intelligence community and law enforcement backdoor access to all of our data. And that should be something that terrifies everybody. I don't know why anybody is okay with this, Adam. And when you mentioned the Gen Zs, the idea, I think that it's just they have been conditioned. I mean, they are the technology generation. They have never known anything different. And I think that they have grown up in a time where Alexa is common and Ring cameras are the norm. And so they don't know any better or know any different. And I don't mean to sound like a condescending boomer here. I'm not a boomer, but I don't mean to sound like a condescending boomer here. But I feel like they've just been conditioned to accept surveillance as part of their existence. And that's a really terrifying prospect. That's not the way that it should be.
Yeah, and I agree with you about that. That's not degrading to the Gen Zers. It's just that's what they know. It's
yes.
Same, when we were younger, our parents would always be like kind of skeptical or hesitant or try to explain that things were different for us than when they were a kid. I mean, excluding the crazy old great-great-grandfather who's like, I used to walk up and down both ways to school in 40 feet of snow, 45 miles to, all that garbage. But the thing is, it's true about, I think of some of the things we had, I still had a rotary phone when I was growing up in throughout high school, although push-button phones were plenty available for at least a decade or two before that. It's just that phones were still that way and they still worked, and there was no reason to get rid of it and buy a new one. But now everyone has these computers in their pockets, and they get a new one every time one is released. They go stand out in line sometimes, camping out days ahead. By the way, excuse me, the Section 702 stuff is set to expire on December 31st. Before I forget, the last reauthorization of it was in 2018. There we go.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this stuff is it's genuinely terrifying. And the idea, again, like I said, the idea that these kids are being conditioned. And again, I don't say kids because I'm being condescending. I mean, to me, you are kids. But I mean, I was born in 1982. I'm 41 years old. And so I grew up in that weird kind of sub-generation, what they call us Xennials. So I'm like a very young Gen Xer or a very old millennial, whichever you prefer. And it's like this weird 5-year age group where we don't really fit into either of the other generations. And in my opinion, it's like kind of the weird, the most awesome place to have been born, obviously. But also it's kind of weird because my childhood was totally analog. I mean, we didn't have computers. We didn't have any of that stuff. I mean, like we had the original Nintendo. That was our gaming system, right? But then in high school, like I got my first computer and I got my first cell phone and stuff like that. And so it's like my childhood was very kind of old school. And then the technology boom was like as I was coming of age. And so it's a very strange position because I remember when things were different, and now it's like I'm looking at the world around me, and it's terrifying. There's cameras everywhere, and there's all of this surveillance happening that we, frankly, we don't even know the full extent of it. So this is a really scary thing for me, the idea that they're so easily, and I hate the whole, if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to worry about. That's absurd. I don't have anything to hide, but the government has no business being in my personal life. You know what I'm saying? They have no business listening to my conversation. So, and that's the way everybody should feel about it. It's absurd that anybody would be okay with this. So yeah, I mean, we'll just keep an eye on this and check out as this develops, and hopefully the 702 stuff in December we can get an update on that. But yeah, this is bad. Surveillance is bad. That's how I feel about it. Adam, we will talk to you again on Monday, and I will be back in just a couple minutes with our guest right here on TNT Radio.
You should hear what James Freeman is talking about on the Freeman Report.
And while the UK doesn't have the same level of problem as in parts of America, Scotland is famous for being the capital of Europe for substance abuse. 9.2% of adults in England and Wales, that's around 3 million people, reported using illicit drugs in the 12 months to June 2022, while 2.7% of adults reported using Class A drugs, which was 4.7% among 16 to 24-year-olds. One of the interesting trends across the COVID period has been a large decline in the use of drugs such as ecstasy and cocaine, possibly due to the closure of nightclubs and other nightlife venues, while other drugs have seen an increase in use, such as magic mushrooms, ketamine, anabolic steroids, and very worryingly, methamphetamine. In terms of drug-related deaths, where the drugs involved are controlled under the Misuse of Drugs Act 1971, the picture is concerning, as deaths have been steadily rising over the past decade.
James Freeman on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
If you came across someone struggling with hunger, how would you recognize them? By their clothes, their age, the way they speak? Would you notice an 8-year-old girl who's not excited for summer break
because she may not be having lunch again until September?
Or a single father of two who works three
part-time jobs and still can't put enough food on the table?
Or maybe a mother who cleans offices at night,
hoping to find meeting leftovers to take home to her hungry family?
Or a war veteran who's having a hard time
landing a job and getting back on his feet.
I am the one in 8 Americans who struggle with hunger. People you pass by every day but never knew were hungry. I am hunger in America.
Hunger can be hard to recognize. Learn why at IamHungerInAmerica.org. Brought to you by Feeding America, 200 Food Banks Strong, and the Ad Council.
TNT. Good for fans of justice and truth. Good for us.
This is today's News Talk Radio.
This is what we stand for.
TNT.
Okay, our guest for the hour is Ford Fisher, who is an independent videographer, editor, and computer scientist web designer. He co-founded and designed news2share.com as an engine for independent videographers and citizen journalists to contribute to the evolving news cycle. He's the editor-in-chief of news2share, and his work has been featured on CNN, Fox, MSNBC, ABC, and more. And he's currently directing news2share's first feature film, and he is an amazing videographer and journalist, and he has covered many of my Assange actions in Washington, D.C., and he's always fantastic. So Ford, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. And I should definitely update that bio. I realized that you just read a bio that I wrote like several years ago. I've got to go back and check on that. But all Jimmy, very nice, though.
Jimmy Dore, you should go read Jimmy Dore's bio on his website. When I had him on the show, I went, Indy was getting his stuff together and he's like, this, like, it still says that he works for TYT.
Right.
Like,
yeah, there you go. Exactly.
I'm like, Jimmy, you need a new bio, my friend.
Right. I co-founded News to Share in college. So yeah. As you just said that, I'm trying to remember if that actually was like pre or post graduation.
I was
working on a computer science minor at the time. So I think that was why I like included, like I designed my website, kind of like contributed to that. Like, see, I know how to do that thing too.
Yeah, that's funny. Yeah. And like I said, Ford has been at, I think pretty much all, maybe, I mean, there's maybe like one that you were out of town or whatever, but every time we do something in DC for Assange, Ford comes out to cover it, and which is great because it's very difficult to get anybody to cover Assange stuff. So except for Fox News has been to the last two, which is interesting. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot going on right now. And I wanted to actually talk to you a little bit about the Trump stuff. I haven't really talked about it much because I've been watching it unfold, watching the way people are responding to this. And I think, right. Ford, I think they're doing nothing but helping him. What do you think?
Yeah, so I mean, I think that there's a lot of challenging, complicating kind of elements to it. But firstly, I mean, you mentioned Julian Assange. It is worth noting that Trump is charged, among other things, with violating the Espionage Act. So Trump kind of paved the way with, you know, it was Obama who did not want to prosecute Julian Assange when it was presented to him. And it was the Trump administration that did that prosecution, as I'm sure you and your audience are well aware. But what people might not realize, because I haven't really seen it in the media characterized this way as much, is that he is being charged the same way that Assange was. 17 of Assange's charges were exactly that. And I believe in Trump's case, it's 31 of them. And so both of those relate to, you know, possession of documents that you're not supposed to have, essentially. In Trump's case, specifically called willful retention of national defense information. I think that this is going to be challenging because on the one hand, Trump has had a lot of time to talk about it in advance. And so his supporters were sort of fully primed for these charges to happen. And I don't think that they are going to, I don't think there's anything that it could say in that indictment that would convince a Trump supporter to no longer be a Trump supporter. And in that sense, you are right that it might impassion them, you know, more in some way. On the other hand, there probably is a certain type of conservative or someone who agrees with Trump's policies, but isn't, you know, but cares more about the policies more than the president themselves, who might say, you know, do I really think that the winning candidate is in a general election is the guy with like 30 felony charges in New York, now 30 something charges federally, and he's got two other grand juries against him. So by the time, you know, the Republican primary is through, he could have felonies in four different states that he's facing off with. Whereas you could just pick Ron DeSantis, who basically believes all of the same stuff and appears to not have those kinds of legal complications. So it'll be interesting because on the other hand, Ron DeSantis is saying like, you know, a DeSantis administration wouldn't do that and whatever. So it's like he's trying to dip into their audience. Like, hey, don't vote for Trump, because if you vote for me, I'll save Trump. And that's kind of a fascinating dynamic.
Yeah, that's a great point. I hadn't really considered that that aspect of it. But yeah, so the charges 1 through 31 are, as you said, willful retention of NDI. Charge 32 is conspiracy to obstruct justice. 33 is withholding a document or record. 34 is corruptly concealing a document or record. 35 is concealing a document in a federal investigation. 36 is scheme to conceal. And 37 is false statements and representations. So, I mean, the reason why I think that they're helping him is because, and I was on Fault Lines this morning with Malik and Jamarl, and we were talking about this, and it because of the way that they're handling the Biden situation, and they're not really, that he's not even been interviewed about that situation, and they're going so hard at Trump. It seems as if they are making, they're proving Trump right when Trump says that he's an enemy of the state and he's going to drain the swamp and he's all of this stuff. It's making him look like those things to his base. And I think that that is just going to make those kinds of people really dig their heels in even further. You might be right about the more moderate Republican who would vote for Trump, you know, because he's a Republican and because, you know, they just vote for Republicans. If he gets through the primary, I think the Republican primary, I think, is going to be incredibly interesting. I mean, now we have Chris Christie and Mike Pence right. jumping in. So, yeah, I think 2024 is going to be a real show in many ways.
Right. I think that there's kind of three factions maybe arising out of the Republican Party. And so, I mean, firstly, most Republicans today still support essentially MAGA's policies, right?
Yeah.
And for the most part, those people fall behind Trump, right? He's their guy. They really like him. Ron DeSantis has gained a certain popularity among, I guess what I would say, like MAGA people who think that he will be a more effective leader, who think that he'll actually win, and who feel like Trump has kind of fallen off the wagon, you know, since leaving the White House. And then there's kind of a third faction, I guess, which would be like essentially the never Trumpers again. But I think that their vote would be kind of minuscule anyway, and also spread across all these other people. Like who is Mike Pence appealing to exactly? Like a certain type of evangelical who was like kind of like held their nose and voted for Trump. Like who is Chris Christie appealing to exactly? Like someone who wants a strong man who doesn't have like, you know, a spray tan. Like, I think that they're, at the end of the day, it's probably a two-way primary race. And then all of these other, you know, the kind of never MAGA crowd is just going to be split up among single digits is sort of the way that I'm seeing it right now. Pence has this problem where like Trump supporters are never going to vote for the person who Trump ended his presidency saying he was betrayed by.
But at the same, for sure.
So I don't think he has a viable path. And honestly, I'm not sure I understand why he's even trying.
I don't either. I feel like he has the personality. I tweeted that out the other day. He has the personality of a spoon. Like he's not engaging or charismatic. I don't know what he thinks he's doing. Obviously he's welcome to run. You're free to run, but it's just bizarre to me that he is running. I don't know what that's about. I'm very interested to see how that all plays out and how that dynamic kind of reveals itself, because you have, you know, with Pence and Chris Christie and all of the, like, they all have these relationships already with Trump. And so seeing how he interacts with them and how they interact with him is going to be really interesting. So let's take a quick break. We're going to get some headlines. We'll be right back with Ford right here on TNT Radio.
Now, news. TNT Radio News.
This is James O'Neill with a check into today's headlines. Former President Trump has responded to being charged with federal crimes related to his handling classified documents, calling it a hoax. President Biden is also under investigation for mishandling classified documents. The air is a lot clearer across the Northeast. Quality reading is under 100 from Washington to New York City after 2 days of hazardous levels, seven times that, with a sky full of Canadian wildfire smoke.
For all the latest community events, rallies, marches, festivals, and fundraisers happening near you, visit the What's On Events calendar on the TNT Radio website at tntradio.live. Stay in touch on TNT Radio.
All right. We are here with Ford Fisher. And okay, so we're talking about the Trump stuff. A part of this that I talked about earlier this morning on Fault Lines was, it's very interesting to me how they're handling this with Trump, and everybody's pretending as if nobody's above the law. Well, that's just not the case, because lots of people have been above the law with very similar situations. David Petraeus gave classified information to his girlfriend. Hillary Clinton had her own personal email servers. Joe Biden was caught with classified information at his home. And all of these situations have been held, are being dealt with very differently than they are dealing with Trump. Do you think that that's going to have any bearing on how people perceive this? Do you think that they're going to see Trump as a victim? Because that's kind of my point that I was making earlier, is it feels as if they're making him look as though he's a victim, and that he's being, you know, there's been like this witch hunt over the past several years against him. And that's a very effective narrative for him to sell to his base.
So I think you're exactly right that Trump is really good at selling that exact narrative. And on its face, that's going to be a narrative that Trump supporters are going to follow. Like you said, it's like Biden's got classified documents at his house. Trump had classified documents at Mar-a-Lago. And one is being prosecuted and one so far hasn't been. However, digging like slightly deeper than that, the point of a special prosecutor in theory is that they are acting independently of the attorney general. So theoretically, at least, Jack Smith hasn't been interacting with Merrick Garland about it. And Joe Biden himself hasn't been sort of like touching it. So theoretically, that decision was made independently. And so it's not like you have one brain saying, we will prosecute Trump, but we will not prosecute Biden. If Biden were to be prosecuted for classified documents, it would be because of somebody else. So it wouldn't be the same person making the charging decisions in both cases. The other question is kind of like magnitude, scope, and did they make efforts to sort of obstruct what had happened? In the case of Biden, there is Merrick Garland appointed a special prosecutor to investigate Biden. Theoretically, Biden could be prosecuted the same way as Trump. But there has been a difference so far, which is at least ostensibly, Biden basically said that he instructed his lawyers, comply, give them everything to show, you know, like just figure it out. But at least in theory, he didn't make sort of an effort to conceal. And part of the case that Jack Smith is making is that Trump was actually aware, not that it was a mistake, but that Trump was actually aware that he had these classified documents and that he tried to move them in order to avoid accountability for it and so forth. Again, this indictment only just came out, and an indictment is only sort of accusations. You know, the indictment is just as the narrative as written by the state, not, you know, able to be scrutinized, defended, whatever by Trump. But at least on paper, the sort of difference appears to be the magnitude of the situation and the efforts to conceal that it happened. Pence also apparently had classified documents in his office. But similarly, it doesn't look like anyone's anticipating Pence getting in trouble over it. Again, because it doesn't seem like he tried intentionally to do that. In the case of Hillary, I mean, you did mention the Hillary thing. I did look this up. I was trying to kind of compare the email situation or whatever. My understanding is that what was found about Hillary's emails was that she had like four classified documents or something like that, which still could have been chargeable. And I remember this being controversial, that Comey was kind of hated by both sides. The right wingers are like, Hillary did the bad thing, you should charge her. But then people on the left were like, this was a small mistake. Why did you right before the election come out with a press conference saying Hillary might have done crimes? And so everyone kind of ended up mad at him. But I think all of these situations in some ways are separate and apart, and that comparison is very easy to make in the public ethos, but might not like legally hold water.
No, for sure. I'm just saying in terms of his supporter base, I think that's going to be the narrative that he sells. Look at me. I'm the victim. These other people have done these things and nobody, I'm the guy that they're coming after. They're all above the law. Why are they picking on me? That's going to be the narrative that he's selling over the next year and a half. And it's going to be incredibly effective, in my opinion, with his base. I think, again, they are going to dig their heels in even further as this progresses, because they see, I mean, as you mentioned, he's been able to speak about this for some time now. I mean, he's been able to get ahead of this story for a very long time. And he's been able to kind of lay that foundation of I'm a victim. And I think that that's going to be really effective for him moving forward through the election.
Right. And the question that it will create is that for his Republican competitors in the primary, again, I'm especially talking about DeSantis here, like, is he going to, in order to keep those people who Trump has convinced of that, will DeSantis have to take the same position? Trump is a victim. Like, I think he, in some ways, by getting all of his audience thinking about that, he is forcing any Republican contender to have to take the same position, or else that person won't be able to hold those voters going into a general election.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I don't know that DeSantis has spoken on this yet. I haven't seen anything. Have you seen anything where
He made a statement on Twitter, which I could pull up so that I can quote it exactly. But as I'm looking for it, the gist of it was that he was saying that if he is elected, then a DeSantis administration wouldn't let this kind of weaponization happen. So he kind of used it to sell himself, actually. As a candidate. Okay, the exact wording was, The weaponization of federal law enforcement represents a mortal threat to a free society. We have for years witnessed uneven application of law depending on political affiliation. Why so zealous in pursuing Trump, yet so passive about Hillary or Hunter? This is the exact point you were kind of making. The DeSantis administration will bring accountability to the DOJ, excise political bias, and end weaponization once and for all. And so this is why I'm saying it's really interesting that the competitor to Trump, rather than saying, hi, my opponent is charged with a bunch of crimes, how about you vote for me, the guy not charged with crimes, instead he's saying, my competitor was charged with crimes, and that's bad, and I'll save him. So it's a really, really strange dynamic here, because in conventional politics, you would think that this would be used sort of as an attack.
Yeah, for sure. And it is interesting. And I think, again, that is because Trump has had the kind of time that he has needed in order to present the situation in his best possible light. And he's created that environment where that you, if you're going to be a Republican and address this, you're going to have to do so very carefully, because you don't want to alienate the Trump voter, for sure. That's a huge block of people. I mean, Trump has, and they're very, very loyal. So if you, that's what I think, it's been very interesting watching DeSantis so far throughout this election is it seems as if he has made a couple missteps in really kind of going hard after Trump. And I think that he probably should have better kind of laid some groundwork with Trump's supporters first before making those sort of attacks, kind of trying to bridge the gap there. And then maybe eventually as the election goes on, that's just my opinion. I mean, I'm not an expert in elections or running campaigns or anything like that, but he came out really hard, really heavy handed. I think that was probably a mistake, because Trump voters are incredibly loyal. And if it does end up in a situation where it is you and Trump, or if Trump ends up being unable to run or finish the race, you have then alienated a huge percentage of your potential voter bloc. So I don't know. It's going to be interesting to watch all this play out and watch, as I said, all these different characters, and especially Mike Pence. I'm going to be very curious to see how he handles this, because he is, again, he was the vice president. And as you mentioned, he also had classified materials. So he's going to have to tread a very careful line there as well. So, okay, we should take a quick break. Hang tight. We're going to be right back with more right here on TNT Radio.
With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
The shocking images of Manhattan skyscrapers enveloped in a sickly orange smog are just the tip of the iceberg of the impact that the Canadian forest fires are having on the northeastern United States. When I saw those images, I checked the air quality index for New York. It was 157. Not good by any stretch of the imagination. But some perspective is in order. Our AQI here in central New York was 334, more than twice as bad as the city. But just as New Yorkers shouldn't fall victim to location bias, meaning that conditions in your area are worse than everywhere else, we in 2023 shouldn't fall victim to temporal bias, thinking that this is the worst it's ever been. That most assuredly isn't true. Go back and look at May 19th, 1780, a day that is still referred to as New England's Dark Day. We have no way of measuring what the air quality index was that day, but we do know that from Portland, Maine, down into New Jersey, it was so dark in midday that people had to light candles in their homes just to do their chores. What is believed to have caused that dark day? That's right, Canadian forest fires. This too shall pass. From MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
It's not just a music box. It's a ballerina's castle. It's a place to keep special things. It's noticing the letter. It's hearing it's for her mom. It's the moment you realize a 10-year-old girl has come to terms with her terminal illness. It's telling her how brave she is. It's agreeing to pass the letter on after she's gone. It's not just a music box. It's one of the most important tools we use. Social work with children and families is changing. Join us. Call 0300 123 1220 or search Be the Difference.
This is the Misty Winston Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
We are joined for the hour by Ford Fisher, who is an independent photojournalist and all around badass. So you mentioned the Assange stuff. So obviously, being who I am, I have to bring that up because we got some unsurprising but ridiculous news yesterday. But the idea that Donald Trump is being charged under the Espionage Act. First of all, personally, I think nobody should be charged under the Espionage Act. The Espionage Act, in my opinion, should be lit on fire and thrown out a window. I don't want anyone to be charged under the Espionage Act. However, as an Assange supporter, the irony, as you mentioned, of Donald Trump being charged under the Espionage Act after he, went after Julian Assange so viciously with the Espionage Act is kind of delicious for me. But what do you think about the Assange situation? Do you think that's going to have any bearing on the election? I feel like momentum has definitely shifted. We're seeing support for Julian Assange grow. We're starting to see it be discussed quite a bit more than it has been previously. What do you think? Do you think, first of all, I'll ask you this. Do you think that Joe Biden actually wants to have Julian Assange brought to the United States? Because I don't think that he does. I think they're just trying to drag this out for as long as they can and keep him silent for as long as they can. But what do you think?
I'd be interested to know why you think that Biden doesn't want him extradited as quickly. I'm not sure I understand that point of view.
I think the whole goal of this, in my opinion, has always been just to keep him silent for as long as possible and to destroy him mentally, physically, spiritually, emotionally, while also sending a message to other journalists around the world that if you come for us, this is what we will do to you. And we actually know that this is a part of their strategy, thanks to Julian Assange himself. He released the Stratfor leaks. There was a conversation that they had in those emails where they discussed their Assange problem and how to deal with it. And one of their strategies was, well, we'll just tie him up in legal stuff for the next 25 years, which is exactly what they're doing. So I think that if they actually extradite Julian Assange to the United States, I think that that then opens them up to quite a bit of scrutiny. And I think that it makes it a lot more difficult for them to do this under the radar. I think that that will bring a lot of attention to the case, knowing that he has then been extradited to this country. And I don't think that that's a Pandora's box that they aren't really interested in opening.
Okay, so fair enough. I think that's sort of an interesting theory. I guess it's sort of hard for me to respond to because I don't know that there's any way any of us could know at this point. But a trend that I guess I kind of track is like how these sorts of prosecutions are sort of used and played in sort of a political sense. Of course, when the actual leaks happened from Chelsea Manning to Julian Assange that Julian Assange is now being prosecuted for, they were leaks that embarrassed the military apparatus. Chelsea Manning herself is someone who is revered more as a hero by the left, and certainly people on the right. I mean, it is a broad coalition of people who are interested in this sort of material, but Julian Assange is not characteristically right-wing in any sort of way whatsoever. However, if you were to kind of watch the mainstream media discussion of it and so forth, as he was being prosecuted, but even before then, and especially surrounding the WikiLeaks leading up into the election, there was a lot of effort to sort of write off Julian Assange as kind of as right wing or as beneficial to the right wing or beneficial to Trump. And so I don't know that the prosecutions of Trump and Assange, even though they are under the same act, will be so linked together. But in the public ethos, I think that the problem that it probably creates for Julian would be that, as Joe Biden is saying, I'm law and order, or the Biden administration or the state is saying we are law and order. Their use of the Espionage Act against both Trump and Assange kind of ties those two people together. These two people are dangers to the security apparatus and whatever. And to the extent that Julian would have sympathetic people among liberals or leftists and so forth, that probably only hurts him to kind of have that further step of kind of faux Trump connection, even though, again, what Assange did that he's being charged for has absolutely nothing to do with Trump himself. Other than that, no. Trump brought the charges.
Right. Yeah, you're right. I know. That's always interesting to me when people are like, Julian Assange helped Trump get elected. Well, Trump sure had a funny way of thanking him. He had him arrested.
Right.
I mean, that's a very interesting dynamic. If the guy helps you get elected and you have him thrown in Belmarsh, I mean, that's ridiculous. But yes, I think that is for sure. I think that, and I think 2016 was a very interesting, the whole Russia gate and the Julian Assange helped Trump get elected and was a Russian asset and all of that stuff. I think that was a really easy way for, and I don't know if it was an intentional strategy, but I think it was a very convenient way for them to kind of sully Assange's reputation amongst liberals. Because previously, I mean, there's a TED talk where Julian Assange gets a standing ovation from a room full of liberals. And now it is quite the opposite. I find I have much better luck with people on the right in terms of getting support for Julian Assange than I do on the quote unquote left or the liberal class, because they are they very much still have that bad taste in their mouth where they think that Julian Assange did some, you know, harm to Hillary Clinton and helped Trump get elected. It's not true, but that's the narrative that was sold. And so those people still very much hold on to that and really believe it. So
there's a question that results from that, which is, do Trump, so we just kind of explained why the left might be even more turned off by Assange by kind of connecting those two. So the question on the other side is, are Trump supporters going to say, oh man, maybe Julian shouldn't have been prosecuted. Maybe the Espionage Act is bad because it's being used against the guy we like. And if I'm being totally honest, I don't think that that's going to happen. like conventionally you could think of that as happening, but to the extent that Trump and his supporters are talking about this, they're going to be talking about it being weaponized against Trump in their opinion. And I don't think that they're going to see it as a broader attack on law. And the kind of experience that I'm drawing from in that is that Trump was very critical of FISA courts because they targeted him. But I never heard Trump talk about FISA courts as being bad because they're surveilling Muslims. That wasn't really a Trump position, right? Or anybody else. It wasn't that FISA courts are bad. It was, how dare you use this against me? And so I do think that the Espionage Act is going to fall under criticism for its application to Trump. But I don't know that Trump is going to make the point that says people who were prosecuted under this have been prosecuted viciously or unfairly or whatever. I think Trump's going to say, it's me, look at me.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, he is a narcissist. So yes, it'll definitely be his take on it. But the experience I have with Trump supporters is they are generally speaking, this is obviously just broad brush here, but they are generally speaking supporters of Julian Assange. However, they have very much memory hold the reality of the situation that Donald Trump is the one that had Julian Assange arrested. Donald Trump is the one that oversaw the spying operation that took place on Julian Assange and the Ecuadorian embassy. Donald Trump also oversaw the plots to either kidnap or assassinate Julian Assange. And they don't like to talk about that. When you bring that up, they get very angry and usually they block me on Twitter. But that is the reality of the situation. And so I think generally they support Assange. They support press freedom and free speech, but they are unwilling to come to terms with the fact that it was their guy that put him there. You know what I mean? It's a very interesting dynamic.
Right. And I think that I've seen that happen with Candace Owens interviewed Trump, and it's one of the only times I've seen him really be asked about this by somebody who apparently does support Julian Assange. And like, he was very, very equivocal about his answer. He said something like, well, there was him and Snowden, and I looked at both cases, and he said something like, I like one better than the other, but he wouldn't say which one it was. And he just said, like, we'll just let it play out in the courts. He took a very, very waffly position on it.
Yes.
Which, even if he had some kind of sympathy kind of in his heart somewhere, you know, he surrounded himself by people like Mike Pompeo, whose solution was like, hey, why don't we try killing him?
Right.
And so I think that Trump was, like, even if he had any kind of sympathy or whatever, you know, he also had these advisors who really wanted to throw the book or literally just assassinate Julian. So, you know, we'll see. Would a Trump second term, if America ever gets to that point, would it be different because you'd have a vindictive Trump who says that he hates the deep state and all these things now that he's been prosecuted by it? I think he would certainly be vindictive, but would he sort of apply that to other people being prosecuted? Or again, would it just be about him?
I think it would almost certainly be just about him. I just think that that's the kind of person he is. I think it's been made clear that he is very much all about Trump. I mean, that's just reality. But it is, I am very interested to see how this all plays out, because I think that it is something that it's going to be difficult for him to avoid that question as the election season moves forward. Why didn't you, first of all, pardon Julian Assange? So over the past couple of days, I've seen so many Trump supporters, I can't believe Trump didn't pardon Assange. And that's when I'm like, what do you mean you can't believe he didn't pardon pardon him. He's the guy that had him arrested. It's completely unsurprising that he did not have him pardoned. So yeah, it's going to be very interesting watching how people react to that. And if he addresses it, I mean, like you said, with Candace Owens, which all credit to Candace Owens, I am not a huge fan of hers for various reasons, but that was, as you said, that was really one of the only times that he's ever been asked about it. So kudos to her for asking. His answer was not fantastic. But we've already seen throughout the kind of announcement of different various candidates. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has said he would pardon Assange. Marianne Williamson has said she would pardon Assange. Cornel West has now entered the race, and he has been a longtime supporter of Julian Assange. So I think that outsider candidates, but not establishment, we'll say, they're going to be overlooked a lot. But I do think that it is going to open up an opportunity for Assange to be an issue that is discussed, at least during this election season. So I'm very interested to see how Trump handles that and how he responds, if he does at all. He may just waffle again.
The other thing to note, though, is that the people who Trump will be running against in his own primary are almost certainly all going to be anti-Assange, right? Ron DeSantis worked at Guantanamo Bay. Mike Pence is Mike Pence. Chris Christie is definitely... I'm trying to remember, but I feel like I remember Chris Christie specifically talking about this issue, but he's also sort of a foreign policy hawk. So like out of all of them, you know, Trump was probably the closest to having any reason to think that he would be sympathetic to Assange sort of out of the Republicans. Other than like Rand Paul is certainly not going to run this year, but like Rand would have been probably the only Republican that would even kind of touch this issue. And so it is interesting to see that Assange has gotten that little uplift in the kind of independent left, like you said, Cornel West, Marianne Williamson, RFK Jr. But the Democratic Party is not even going to allow there to be debates. From their perspective, the primary is a done deal, right? I mean, it's like, basically, they're not going to use the word fixed or rigged, but they're just going to say, well, we're not holding a primary. We already chose our guy. So take it or leave it. So I don't know that Julian would really end up with a lot of airtime in a debate, because the Democrats aren't having a debate, and so Biden will presumably be the victor. I mean, of course, it's possible that RFK or one of these people somehow ascends, but like realistically, Biden is probably the nominee, and he is obviously anti-Assange. He's the one fighting to continue Trump's prosecution of Assange, and then so Biden ends up debating probably either Trump or DeSantis. So you've got the Biden doing the prosecution and Trump who started the prosecution, and those two people are going to debate. What question would you even ask them? You know, right? So you guys still feel like prosecuting Assange? Trump's like, yep, I started it. Biden's like, yep, still working on it. Okay, moving on. Like, I'm not sure how much that would end up being an election issue, if I'm being honest.
No, I don't think it's going to be a mainstream election issue, but I do think it is going to be something that is discussed this time around, which is definitely different from previous years. I mean, as I mentioned earlier, we have seen a pretty significant momentum shift. The idea, frankly, that there are even three candidates running for president who will even say Assange's name is astonishing. I mean, we now have, so-called progressives in Congress who have written a letter to Joe Biden. I mean, listen, it's just a strongly worded letter, but 4 years ago, that would have been unheard of. The idea that anybody in Congress would even, I mean, they haven't even said his name up until this point. He's been in prison for 4 years. It took 4 years for anybody to even say his name. So the idea that we have three pseudo left or leftist candidates who are speaking about it fairly frequently and have made it like a pretty significant a point in their campaign to call for the release of Julian Assange, I think is a huge momentum shift. I don't think it'll be part of the mainstream conversation, obviously. I think that that's the last thing they want. That's why they have spent so much time trying to keep this issue under wraps. But the momentum shift, I think, is significant. And the DeSantis thing, I think, is infuriating. I have interviewed Mansoor Adaifi, who has talked about Ron DeSantis and his participation in torture at Guantanamo. And I think he is a vile, despicable human being. And so, the idea that he would ever support Julian Assange, who exposed some of the things that were going on at Guantanamo, is unthinkable. It will not happen. I just think it's going to be it's going to be a lot. I think because I'm somebody who is fairly divorced from electoral politics, I don't think it's a game changer. I don't think we're going to get any significant change through the electoral process. It's going to be entertaining for me to watch all of this stuff develop on both sides, because I feel like it's already become, you have the Democratic Party saying, no, we don't do democracy here. We're not having a primary. We're not having debates. We're not doing any of those things, which should surprise nobody who was paying attention in 2016 during the DNC fraud lawsuit. They literally went into a court of law and said, listen, we'll go in a back room filled with cigar smoke, choose our guy. There's nothing you can do about it. So this is not surprising at all, but I think it is very interesting. And I am just very curious as we move forward, because I don't think Biden can even make it to the next election. He is not doing well. It's astonishing the decline that he has taken.
Even if he didn't, it would probably be taken over by somebody who is essentially a Biden equivalent politically.
Yes.
Like even if Biden had some kind of a health catastrophe or whatever, like it would probably be passed off to Kamala Harris, or if not Kamala Harris, although I think it
Hillary
would be her.
Hillary Clinton.
No. I'm willing to bet it all on it will not be Hillary Clinton. I think they would know that would be a catastrophic, unpopular, like that would be a mistake on their end. But what I'm saying is they're not going to say, oh, Biden had a health issue, so RFK Jr. has won the Democratic primary.
Right? Absolutely
that would not.
Not
be the, that's not how it would go. And then we would actually, he would win the presidency for sure, but he wouldn't.
Right.
But no, they would never give that. They would never give that to him. I don't think that it's ever going to end up being a conversation. And I would also point out that like when I've seen the Biden administration be asked about Assange, both in the State Department press briefings, but also the White House press briefings, they usually just try to like go, well, I'd refer you to the DOJ. And then there's no real way to ask the DOJ. And so I think that it's an issue that Biden, while he has been steadfast about like they are fighting for the prosecution, which he could have just ended if he wanted to. So I'm not saying that he's not motivated to make the prosecution continue, but he is clearly not trying to even talk about it. He doesn't want this to be an issue in the public discourse.
No, they want to keep Assange out of public consciousness as much as humanly possible. It makes it much easier for them to do what they're doing to him if nobody's paying attention. So Ford, thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show. I really appreciate you. I appreciate all your work, as I've told you many times. Everybody can check out Ford on Twitter at Ford Fisher. You can find links to all of his work on the Substack, mistywinston.substack.com. As Julian Assange says, learn, challenge, act now. Do not go anywhere. The Reckoning with Timothy Shea is right after this here on TNT Radio.